Hi there, listener, and welcome to episode 227 of the Ski Podcast. This episode is the fourth in a series of podcasts I'm publishing this winter, focusing on women in the snow sports industry. First up was BBC Ski Sunday presenter Chemi Alcott. We followed that with GB Snow Sports CEO Vicky Gosling, then the former managing director of ski company Earn Low, Joanna Yellowy-Spound. You can catch up with all of these episodes in our back catalogue. Today, I'm delighted to bring you my conversation with Lucy Aspden-Keane, ski and snowboard editor at The Telegraph. We cover Lucy's journey from the Blackpool Gazette to an MA in journalism and how she beat 300 other applicants to win a ski internship at The Telegraph. Lucy shares her advice for aspiring travel journalists, plus what it was like working on the travel desk during COVID. We also discuss how a trip to Nepal that included climbing a 6,000 metre peak was prompted by an interview with Ranulf Fiennes. I'm sure you'll find her story as interesting as I did. But before we start, I'd like to share a piece of news that broke just after we published our last episode. And the big news is that after taking place the last 2 years at Excel in East London, next year it's moving back to Olympia in West London. It will be held on the weekend of 18th-19th October 2025, and it will be preceded in 2 days beforehand with Listex, the industry's trade networking event. Now, many listeners will know that for years the ski show was based at Olympia, but the last time it was held there was in 2010. This is an ambitious move. Almost certainly it will improve the atmosphere. I love the fact that at Olympia there are two levels, so you can look down to the main floor, and it'll be really interesting to see what features they include. I would love to see a real snow slope down there with some of our great freestyle athletes showing off their skills, but we'll see. So I just wanted to bring you this news, and I'll cover it in more detail in future episodes. Finally, before we start, I'd like to thank Intersport Ski Hire for sponsoring the podcast and for making all of these episodes possible. Don't forget that you can save money when you book your ski hire at intersportrent.com and use the code SKIPODCAST. And to make it even simpler, you don't even need to use the code. Just take the link in the show notes and your basket will automatically be reduced. Right, let's listen to my interview with Lucy Aspden-Keane, ski and snowboard editor at The Telegraph. I'm delighted to be joined today by Lucy Aspden-Keane. Lucy's Twitter bio describes herself as a fresh air junkie and dog owner, but more relevant to us today, Lucy is ski and snowboard editor at The Telegraph. And Lucy, I know that's not your actual job title, but we'll come on to that later. Regular listeners will recognise her voice, as Lucy has been on the show before, telling us about Gouster in Norway, heli skiing in Chile, and back in the dark days of lockdown and testing, she was on the show in 2020 and 2021. Hi, Lucy. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Ian. This is quite an exciting one to record, a bit different to the other ones.
Exactly. And whereabouts are you today?
So I'm at home in Preston, up in the northwest this morning.
That's kind of interesting. We'll come to that as well. I think many people assume that, you know, everything ski journalism or journalism related is London based and that you have to live there. So we're going to come on to your career path later, as I think a lot of our listeners will be interested to get some tips on how to make a career in travel journalism. But I wondered if we could just start off our conversation with something. It's actually, it's still about the mountains, but it's completely different from skiing, and have a little chat about your trip to Nepal that you did. I think it was a couple of years ago now. Am I right in saying that that idea started through a conversation you had, or maybe you were interviewing Ranulf Fiennes?
It was indeed, yeah. So that incredible experience all happened back in 2019. That's when it all started, and I'm trying to get my dates right here. I think it's 2019. So Ranulf Fiennes was booked to be the lead speaker, the headline speaker at the Telegraph Ski and Snowboard Show, which the Telegraph used to host in Battersea Park in October half term. And as part of that, for the magazine, we'd want to promote the show and things like that, and we managed to get the opportunity to interview Ranulf. And yeah, it just came off the back of that. I did a really interesting interview with him. It got rearranged, and he actually ended up calling me. I was at home here in Preston, and it was like a Friday afternoon about 5:30, so I think I'd actually logged off work, and I was in my bedroom and my phone rang, a random number, and I just picked up and he goes, "Hello, Lucy, it's Ranulph. And I just all of a sudden had to think, oh my goodness. I just realized who I'm speaking to. I was like, one second, let me get a laptop and a pen, and did this interview with him. And then ended up going in the newspaper and in the magazine as well. And then, yeah, the brand Tenzing, who have involvement with Sherpa Tenzing's family, got in touch with me after I posted it on my social media saying, feeling very inspired to climb some big mountains after speaking to him. And then from there, it just kind of snowballed and I ended up in Nepal.
You're saying to me that Tenzing contacted, they saw the interview, then they contacted you and invited you out to Nepal. This is sounding like a great advert for being a travel journalist.
Yeah, sure. It certainly is. It was, it's one of those things where you have to pinch yourself and remind yourself how lucky you are to have the job that you have. But yeah, that's kind of how it worked. They were working with Jamling Tenzing, who's Sherpa Tenzing's son, to launch a series of treks and climbs and hikes in Nepal. So they were looking for media coverage of that.
When you did go over there, you didn't climb Everest, but you went up to Everest Base Camp and still climbed, I think, like a 6,000-meter peak. Where did you go and what did you take on?
Yeah, so we went. We flew out to Kathmandu, and then we went into the Khumbu region, which is obviously the most famous region in Nepal, I'd say, for people going out and trekking. So we did the main first goal was Everest Base Camp, which was a brilliant experience in itself. And I kind of set myself the target of, if I get to base camp, that's great. Like, that's a real achievement. We were raising money for charity while we were there as well. But the secondary goal was a peak called Le Boucher East. And it's, for people in the world of mountaineering and into their walking and stuff, it is quite commonly known as like a trekking peak. So suitable for, and I put this very lightly, they say beginners, but that's a whole other conversation, I think. And yeah, that's 6,119 meters. So we reached base camp and then kind of did a U-turn back, and Le Boucher is opposite on the other side of the valley from Everest, and you look across at the Everest ridgeline.
Okay. And so how many days was your trek in total then?
So we were away from home for 2.5 weeks. I think we were out on the trail, including the peak, for about 16 days. I can't quite remember. I think we got to base camp on day 7, and then we came back down, and then Le Boucher, and then back down to Kathmandu. So it's roughly about 2 weeks we were walking and moving.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great. Something I'd love to do. I've been to Nepal, but over on the Annapurna side of things. But what I do is I've run quite a lot of trail marathons in the Alps. And one of the challenges I always have for that is that you're training, I live in Brighton. So the highest peak around my way is about 220, 230 meters above sea level. But even though you live near the Lake District, there's a limit on how you can train for that. How did you train for trekking to base camp and up to 6,000 meters?
Well, luckily we ended up, good to look at it this way, everything happens for a reason, because we were due to go. I got the phone call in the October saying, do you want to come? And we were going to be going that following April, which is a very quick turnaround when you've never done that type of climbing or long distance trekking before. But then this little thing called the COVID pandemic happened, and we went into lockdown about 2 weeks before we were supposed to go. And that then actually ended up giving us another 2 years to train. So we did do an awful lot in the Lake District, because Jamling's advice was, for that type of expedition, the best training you can do is back-to-back days of long distance walking on a variety of terrain. So getting used to rocky terrain or just normal paths, doing ups and downs. So we did almost every weekend, especially in the lead up, for about 6 months, we were up in the Lake District. But I also was skiing at the same time. So I was getting out to higher altitude. I think that winter I went out to like Tien and Ledders Alps. So went quite high up onto their glaciers. And then I also used the Altitude Centre. We're a partner of the expedition. So they've got a base down in London, but they also do, you can hire equipment that they send to your house, and you use it as, it mimics being altitude. So we bought a secondhand cycling bike, put it in our kitchen, and used to just spend an hour every evening at cycling this bike at around 5,000 meters and changing the altitude. You can get tents and you can sleep in them as well. It's whether or not that works. I think it did work. It helps you boost the red blood cells in your system. But that was kind of how I did it. A lot of gym training as well. I used to take the machine to the gym and just walk on the treadmill with it, things like that. So it was a whole experience, something I'd never really done before with such a big goal in the end.
Well, I mean, that sounds fascinating. A lot of training there. And you mentioned you were delayed by COVID. I think during that time when we weren't allowed to go anywhere, part of your training was going up and down your stairs nonstop for a long time.
Yeah, it's incredible how many people remember that. I feel like no one will read this when I do this. But yeah, that was, we did that on the day that we were actually supposed to be going on the original trip. It's like, right, what can we do? And me and two of the other team members attempted to climb Everest on our stairs. I got to base camp, and then one of the guys, he reached the summit. I think it took him just shy of 24 hours.
Yeah, in terms of the climb up to Le Boucher East, I mean, you said it's for beginners, you know, a trekking summit. But I think, you know, anything that's that kind of altitude is never going to be easy. How was the actual experience of summiting it?
It was probably one of, and probably remains to be, one of the most challenging days that I've ever had on a mountain. I really wouldn't call it a trekking peak because it does require, you're on a fixed rope pretty much the whole way, especially when you reach the crampon point and snow line. And you're setting off like a traditional expedition. So setting off at 12:30 at night, and we summited around 7:30. There's a lot of like climbing on really solid snow, but also some rock climbing, all attached to a fixed line. But it was extremely challenging when you get to that altitude. It's not just a walk in the park, and it does involve abseiling back down as well. So it was a lot more complicated than just your average beginner walk or trek.
Sorry, abseiling back down. I'm thinking Tom Cruise going into the Saint-Denis Stadium here.
Well, yeah, at some points it was that type of abseil, but no, you're on a fixed line and you've got to get down however you think. But we were the first to summit that day. So if you imagine we're coming down as people are coming up and there's only one line, at points you've got to be really know what you're doing in terms of how to keep hold of that line. You're attached by a carabiner. But it's all about like skill of getting down a rock face that is vertical. That's like traditional abseiling. So there was a lot involved, and you're absolutely exhausted after being up from that time and being at that altitude. It was an absolutely brilliant experience. I did a lot of video vlogging whilst I was out there, and it's interesting to look back sometimes and just see just how exhausted I look. And I think at the time that all the guys said to me, "Oh, would you do another?" And I think at the time I was like, no, it's too much. But then now we're about 2 years down the line, and I'm like, oh, maybe I would.
Sounds fantastic. And I'll put a link to some of your content that you mentioned there in the show notes. I mean, I wondered if you obviously did a lot of preparation for that trip. You did a lot of training, saying you're going out for, you know, weekends for back-to-back walks, etc. I mean, you are a travel journalist, and over-tourism is a big topic in travel these days. Do you think too many people are going to and basing themselves at Everest Base Camp?
I think it's a really interesting conversation, and I've actually spoken to quite a lot of people about this and written quite a lot about it since we came back from Nepal. I will admit to being, when we first went in 2022, quite naive to the whole industry and the over-tourism issues and actually what is required to do that type of experience, and also in some respects what isn't required to do that experience. I think there's a huge problem around over-tourism and around Everest, whether it's just the trek to base camp or the people actually on the mountain. Ever since we went, the thing is that I fell in love with that region and the people when we went to visit, and we've still got really strong connections out in the Khumbu now. And when you see some of the behavior and the activity on Everest in particular as a mountain, I've never climbed Everest, so I can't really have a really strong and authoritative opinion about it. But it does raise a lot of questions around conditions, safety, the amount, if you've got, how much money do you have? Does that help you get to the top? the impact it has on the Sherpa guides and their role in it all. And I'm sure the listeners will have seen many news stories around it. And I try and have written reports into it in the past about, is it over-touristed? Why are people so obsessed with Everest? I understand why they are. It's the biggest mountain in the world, but there are other places. I just hope people who go there appreciate it for what it is and appreciate the local people. And sometimes you get a sense that they don't. They're not quite understanding how fragile an ecosystem that is and how fragile a culture it is. And I think things have started to change in the past few years and people are a lot more aware of that. But it's a very hot topic every year, I think, when the Everest climbing season comes around.
And, you know, we mentioned the amount of training you did. I think that maybe you suggested in one of your pieces there that there are too many climbers going up to that area who are undertrained, so therefore they're relying too much on their Sherpa team to get them there.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting interviews I've done since we came back from Nepal was with a company called Global Rescue. They offer insurance, but they also offer on-mountain rescue. And I interviewed the people who would be involved in rescuing people if they got into trouble on Everest. And their opinion very much was there are too many inexperienced climbers going to Everest without any experience of big mountain climbing before. There's a lot of calls for the government to bring in almost like restrictions in terms of you have to have a CV to prove you've climbed to a certain level or technical experience. Whether that will ever happen, I don't know. To limit the number of permits is another one that those people, those experts would recommend. But it's a huge business for Nepal, and it brings in a lot of money for people who otherwise would still be really traditional Sherpa farmers. And they do benefit a lot from the tourism. It's just how it's managed, I think, that's the main conversation.
We could probably do a whole podcast on this topic. As you know, I have you on the show and you know, you're a leading travel journalist. So I wonder if we could just touch on over-tourism as a concept a little bit more, because there is this balance the whole time with local communities benefiting from people coming and injecting money into the economy and the impact it has on people who live in those areas. And you know, Nepal probably isn't such a good example, but I'm thinking of places like Barcelona or Venice or something like this, where you know the cost of living has gone up dramatically for anyone local, can't afford to live there anymore. And if he had a view on that and the direction that this concept of over tourism is going.
I think the Telegraph has actually been quite at the forefront of the whole over-tourism debate. We do look at these destinations year on year, it changes, but there's always that same narrative of the impact on local people. I think this year has been quite interesting in the fact that there have been anti-tourist protests in the likes of Spain and Greece. And it's quite shocking to see, really, because it is, in my opinion, it's about finding a balance, because these places do in some respects rely on tourism to function, and it does bring good benefits to these places, but it's how tourists act when they get there, behavior, how they contribute, the places that they shop, the places that they stay. I just think it's more an education in making wise and thoughtful choices when you go on holiday. I don't think we're ever going to stop visiting Venice or Barcelona. It's just more about the approach you take when you go to visit these places. And the stuff that we do at the Telegraph, we maybe look at alternatives to, like, think about why you want to go to this place. Well, if it's because of X, is there somewhere else that would be able to offer you that? And are you getting the most authentic experience when you go to these places? And that's where it becomes interesting as a travel writer. It's finding those alternatives or the ways to visit these places that are maybe a little bit more local and authentic.
Yeah, there's so much that we could discuss in this area. But I think maybe we will leave it with the point underlined that if you respect the locals who live there and take a mindful approach to it in terms of, you know, how you're going to spend your money when you're there, then that is going to be the best way to benefit the destination that you're going to. Let's segue on from
a more general chat about tourism to get specific about the mountains. There's no skiing in Nepal. Well, not for most people. But I think all of us listening to this podcast do love the mountains. And we've mentioned the lakes a few times. I know you've even skied up there when there's enough snow. But I wondered if I could ask you how you started skiing. How did you first experience the sport?
So I first went on my first ski holiday when I was in year seven at high school. It was your standard Crystal ski holiday package. Me and my parents with my best friend and her parents, we went out to a little resort in Austria called Rauris. And one day I will go back, like it holds such fond memories. And we probably went back to the same resort, the same hotel every February half term for about 3 or 4 years until I left high school. And that was it, really. That's how I got into it. Just hopefully how lots of children get into skiing, just going on their first ski holiday and falling in love with it.
Possibly there's fewer children who are getting to have that opportunity through school trips, etc. But it's very important that people come into the sport. But it is interesting to me that I guess you didn't do a ski season. You're a career journalist, and I've been lucky enough to interview several, you know, ski journalists on the show. I mean, listeners may have heard my interviews with people like Peter Hardy or Arnie Wilson, Frank Baldwin. But there's two big differences between, you know, those three that I mentioned and yourself. Firstly, they are what we have to call it, like the older generation. They came out of Fleet Street and, you know, that print environment. And secondly, they're obviously all men. And that's one of the reasons I really wanted to speak to you about your career and your journey to where you are now. I think you always knew that you wanted to work in magazines and or journalism.
Yeah, it was magazine journalism in particular that when I was at probably around college, I started to realise that was the kind of career path I wanted to take. I didn't at that point really know a specialism or think that I would have a specialism. If I was to say if I wanted a specialism, I would have probably said women's magazines. Like any 18-year-old girl, the magazines such as Glamour magazine and Cosmopolitan, those were the places that I was applying for internships at down in London. But yeah, it was always magazines that really drove my interest.
Right. And so therefore, in your university education, you did an English literature degree, I think, and you were looking at internships. But I read somewhere else that, you know, when you're doing those internships, they were saying, look, you need to have qualifications. You just can't go into journalism off the back of nothing. And that led you to an MA.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it was when I did a week's work experience at the Blackpool Gazette newspaper up here. And it was the journalist there who said, if you want to be in chance of getting any type of internship or work placement, especially down in London, you need to get an NCTJ, which is the official national training for journalism, basically. And that's where you learn the real nuts and bolts of being a journalist. And then I looked into the different routes to do an NCTJ, and you can just do NCTJ on its own, and it can be quite quick. I think you can do it in the space of 2 months, really intensive course. Or I was very lucky in the fact that Preston University, so UCLAN, Lancashire University, was and still is one of the leading journalism universities in the country. There's not many of them, and they offered a master's that did the master's and the NCTJ, and the price difference wasn't that much different. So I decided to do both, specialism in magazine journalism, that's what my MA was in, and then do the NCTJ as part of that course.
I think it was as a consequence of doing the MA at UCLAN that led to your job at the Telegraph, or certainly an internship to start off with.
Yeah, definitely. So the course wrapped up in about May or June, and at that point you start thinking, right, okay, got to get out there and try and find a job somewhere. And it was my tutor on the course, actually, who had spotted that the Telegraph were advertising for an intern on their new ski magazine. And at that point, the Telegraph had just acquired the media group that owned what was previously Daily Mail Ski and Snowboard, Metro Ski and Snowboard, and it was rebranding as the Telegraph Ski and Snowboard. And the Telegraph had a huge push at that time for internships, and more importantly for me, paid internships, because a lot of the time in journalism, you can go and work and do an internship and get paid your expenses for the week. And a lot of those jobs are down in London, if not the majority of those jobs are down in London. And with no family or somewhere that I can go live for free, I had to try and find somewhere that would actually pay me to come and live in London, or, well, at least move to London. And that was how it kind of began.
It sounds like the perfect job. I mean, evidently you are still there right now, which, so therefore we kind of know that you were successful in that application. I don't know if there was only one job, but I think I read that there were 300 applicants for that particular internship.
Yeah, I still remember when I got the phone call, that it was just incredible, really. It was a really intense application process. We had to send videos of us as part of the application. Then it was a full day with a group of about 20 of us doing different tasks and interviews. And then, yeah, I got a phone call on the Friday night. Can you start in 10 days? So that was when the panic of, okay, well, where do I live? Started and did a few panic trips down to London the following week, ended up staying with a friend for a week, and then found a flat to move into. And as they say, the rest is history. It's actually 10 years ago, last week, I think, was my first day at the Telegraph.
That's made me think of a whole bunch of things. Actually, I spoke to Joanna Yellis-Bound, the former MD at Earn a Low. When she first went for her interview with the eponymous Miss Earn a Low, she offered her a job on the spot. So she'd gone down to London, been interviewed by her, was offered a job to go out to La Plagne the next day, and she didn't even have a passport with her. So she worked out a way around that. You know, when the right job comes up, you can always find a solution, can't you? But that job was specifically at the new ski magazine. So were those interviews by like HR, or were they by people who you're going to be working with at the magazine itself?
It was mainly through the Telegraph Academy, which is where they focused on their internship program. So the main day was definitely with the Academy HR department. I think I must have had an interview with Henry Druce at some point on that day. And no offence, Henry, I can't remember it. It was a long day, but I'm sure we did speak on that day. And then I was really lucky enough to go and be able to work with Henry and the team from then on.
And what was your role then initially? You know, you're an intern. Sometimes interns get, I know you said it was paid, but sometimes they get given all of the least interesting jobs to do. But I think it was a bit more substantial for you.
Yeah, it certainly was. I was going into it with the full qualifications of actually applying for any real journalism job, really. So the focus was primarily on the print magazine. But at that point, we were transferring a lot of content onto the Telegraph's website. So I was working across all multiple platforms, whether it was print pages, there was a bit of writing, a lot of picture research. When I was an intern and I was at that level, I actually looked back and some of the jobs were so fun. I had a big role in the annual fashion shoot that the magazine used to do, which was a week shooting out in Austria. And for much of about a month, I'd spend my life in a cupboard organizing ski clothes. And it was an absolute dream, literally up to my eyes in jackets and gloves and hats. But then the Telegraph also had the ski show at that point. So I worked a lot on that event. And actually, that was where I started to do a little bit of specialism in social media. And that was kind of where I really laid my foundations at the Telegraph. And for the ski industry in particular, that's where I kind of found a bit of a gap, that people weren't doing social media as much as they could. And that was kind of how I got my foot in the door and convinced them, once the 6 months was up, you know what, let me stay on and let's develop social media a bit more. And that's kind of where it all snowballed.
Evidently, you did latch on to something there that maybe other people were missing out on. And I think there was a focus on video snow reports, which seems kind of an obvious thing to do now. But maybe you were driving one of the first people to drive that in that area.
I think it was video snow reports, and Facebook Live was another huge one. I know Facebook Live is maybe lesser of a thing now, but at the time, especially for the event, being able to broadcast live from Battersea Park and promote the, in particular, the competitions we held on slope, we were getting viewing figures that were just incredible. And the reach of those posts was just something that people hadn't really seen before. And then translating that to the mountains during the season and giving live coverage in terms of snow reports or just videos from our trips was a really new way to present stories. And I think that's why I quite enjoyed it, because it felt fresh and it felt new. And the stories were there to be told in every different medium. And social media was a good opportunity for that.
Sure. And it must have worked, because I think I'm right in saying that you doubled the number of Facebook followers, Facebook fans over that period, and picked up a couple of awards as well. Maybe best social media campaign.
Yeah, we did. It was best social media campaign of the year at the PPA Awards. That trophy's on my desk in London somewhere. It seems a long time ago, but that was all around the video campaigns we did around snow reports, or we did things from the snow domes in the UK. We ran quite a few series of videos and saw some really good results from that.
And so when you started at Telegraph then, I mean, you got that job because there was the new magazine and the show was going on as well. And now neither of those two things exist anymore. You know, I know you love magazines. You said it before. Do you miss them?
I do miss them in respect of it was a brilliant time. But in many respects, it's nice to have had that different portion of my career. I've stayed at the same company for 10 years now, and a lot of people in a decade would have maybe moved around a few jobs, especially in journalism. People do change jobs quite regularly. And I think just the change in pace and focus over the past decade has allowed me to feel like I've had quite a few different jobs. It was a brilliant time working on the event and the magazine, and I got the chance to work with some brilliant people. We had such a good time. So I do miss it in that respect, but the next chapter has been a whole different challenge in its own respect.
You're kind of prompting my next question now, because, you know, when the Telegraph decided they weren't going to do that show anymore, it did actually come, you know, just before COVID. And, it always sends a shiver up my spine to think of that time now, because I certainly didn't enjoy it. But the Telegraph coverage in travel was excellent. You know, it was evident to me at the time that you clearly had some kind of close links with government, you know, when, you know, I started subscribing around that time. And there was a live blog that you did, which was always packed full of information. That was a very different type of journalism from what you've been doing before.
Yeah, that was very much a career defining period. I think they're a once in a career type of event, hopefully. And the way that you have to approach it as a journalist is totally different to what you were doing a week before. We ran the live blog on the travel desk, and I actually probably sat in this exact spot, and it involved being on from 7 a.m. We'd do it in shifts, but you almost had to post updates every 15 minutes at one point. So it would be finding the news, finding the story, writing it, uploading it. It was a really intense time to be a travel journalist, mainly because I know you say it sounded like we had inside tracks, but we may have had inside tracks, but those inside tracks didn't come until 10 minutes before we were allowed to say anything about them. It was so last minute and so unexpected. We didn't know what was coming week on week. And I think when the first time I was on the podcast was actually around the time that we thought ski was going to reopen and the resorts were going to reopen, and I was trying to get out to the Alps. And just the fact that someone who's writing about it and reading about it every day, I was in such limbo as to whether I was going to get anywhere, is just case in point as to how haphazard that time was in terms of trying to plan travel, but also write about travel.
The rules are changing the whole time, trying to stay on top of it, what type of tests you needed and how long you might need to stay in quarantine and things like that. I almost have panic attacks thinking back to that time. But did you ever feel that this could be the nail in the coffin for travel?
No, I don't think so. I think we always remain quite positive at the Telegraph that it was never going to be the end. There was always going to be an end to it, whatever. We just didn't know what that end was going to look like. And I think in particular for ski, because we'd gone through Brexit and it's such a niche industry in itself, it was really quite challenging to think, well, what does it look like in 6 months, or what does it look like in a year? The wider travel business is such a huge industry. That was almost a little bit easier to understand. But when we really got into the niche of ski, that was where I really did rely on my contacts and my experts in the industry to give me a bit of direction as to what do you think, what are skiers wanting, but also what are destinations saying.
Fortunately, we seem to move beyond that. Hopefully we won't go back to that again. And I mentioned before that the Telegraph model has shifted towards a subscription in recent years. And that digital focus is very important to the Telegraph. They're so much more social now. Do you think there's still room for longer form content?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what's quite exciting about what I'm working on at the moment. The subscription model has allowed us to kind of refocus efforts on quality over quantity. And the Telegraph are really pushing forward with, I'd call them wide format articles, but they're articles where they can be long form in terms of word count, but also really visually brilliant and stunning on the mobile screen. I think what I quite like about this style of journalism is it's bringing a lot of those skills of working on a magazine where you've got to bring a page, a print page to life with multiple different elements, pictures, boxes, whereas we're almost doing that on the digital page. But we have, the world is our oyster. It's endless what we can put onto a digital page, video, pictures, boxes, interviews, different articles within articles. And I think that's the quite exciting thing about journalism sometimes is you think, oh, there's no magazine anymore. You're being de-skilled, downgraded. Well, actually, I'm learning different things every single week. And technology just is constantly developing in the sector.
That is for sure. And as that model has changed and that digital focus has changed, I mean, I think things like super fast broadband made so much difference. I mean, back in the day, some of our listeners will certainly be aware it used to take you ages just to download an image. And now you can watch, HD videos very easily. So thinking about how your role has changed. I mean, initially I described you as a, ski and snowboard editor because I thought it was easier. But your role now is, you're commissioning all sorts of different articles and also currently working on broader topics like travel guides etc as well. But what is for someone who's thinking about maybe being a journalist, what is your typical day like?
So if I was to give it the official title, it'd be commissioning editor. I am doing a role at the moment where I'm a travel features and guides editor, but if we stuck with commissioning editor, which is quite a recognizable term if people were applying for journalism jobs, that would be almost the job title you'd be looking for. It's really quite varied, so it involves the main part in commissioning other writers to write stories for me and for the ski section. If we focus just on ski, it's much easier deciding what stories do we want for ski, what's the angle, what's the news this winter, what do we want to be saying, and then commissioning people to write stories for that. Also accepting pitches from people who might come up with from writers with ideas. Like the experts come to me and they know a story I don't know about, commissioning them to write those for me. But then that copy eventually arrives in my inbox at some point after quite a bit of admin sometimes. And then it's editing, working with pictures, making sure we can bring the story to life. And then actually getting it out onto the print and digital page once it's edited and looking its best. There's a lot of ideas generation involved in it, coming up with, right, how can we cover ski again for another winter in a new and exciting way? What haven't we done in the past? What are the Telegraph ski readership looking for this winter? And that's the really exciting bit for me around the start of the season, is getting an idea for what are we going to say this winter and what are people wanting and researching and reading. And it's my job to kind of know that and deliver it to them in a way that they want it being delivered.
If you were looking to give advice to people out there who are listening to this who would love to be a ski journalist or a travel journalist, do you think journalists need to have all of the skills in their locker these days, as well as writing? By that, I mean video editing, etc. as well.
It certainly helps. It certainly helps to understand how it works. Maybe not video editing, brilliant if you can edit a video together for me, but it's not something I'd expect. being able to understand the process that an article goes through in terms of the production process, pictures, editing, helps you just refine your copy. It helps you understand that you may be a brilliant writer, but if you're a brilliant writer but you overfile by 1,000 words, it really doesn't help the process at all, and your words are only ever, they're only going to get wasted. So an understanding of how to edit copy down as well is really a great sign of a good journalist. And also having ideas as to how to bring that to life visually. A lot of journalists these days take their own pictures for me, and they're brilliant because they're there on the story, so they know what will bring that, those words to life. So yeah, I've always tried to have lots of skills in my toolbox, and I do think it really does help to be a modern journalist that way.
And, you know, as well as obviously the ability to be able to type on your phone while you're on a chairlift and not drop your phone at the same time, you know, what advice would you offer to someone then who did want a breakthrough? How do they get, apart from, you know, having the qualifications to give them, you know, the ability to get, let's say, an internship or a job, if someone wants a breakthrough as a freelance journalist, you know, how would they do that? How would they get you to, or the Telegraph, to publish an article for them?
I mean, I really don't envy the world of freelance journalists. I absolutely rely heavily on the pool of Ski freelance journalists. So if you're all listening, thank you very much. And I'm sorry if it takes me forever to reply to your emails. But making those connections and networking is key. I meet our writers at events, or I have communication with them on social media. That's how I meet new writers. And that's how I get to understand who has an expertise in certain areas. I think it's quite exciting, actually, that the role that social media plays for finding new writers, and actually becoming aware of people who might have an interesting thing to say in the ski world. So having a really strong social media presence to demonstrate your skills, whether they're digital, video, pictures, but you can also, words are on there as well. And just being part of the ski community online is a great way to just get your foot in the door.
Excellent. And just to kind of segue back to a possible threat to anyone who's thinking about going into this area, or you can tell me if you think it is a threat or not. What about AI? I have my own views on it, but let's just hear what you think. Is that a threat to, you know, journalists?
I might be naive in saying this, and I will admit that it's not an area that I know a lot about. I've got to say, no, not at the moment. I think for Telegraph Travels Reader, they really value knowing who their expert is. They appreciate that name. They appreciate that face. And they appreciate the Telegraph as a name, delivering them reliable, well-researched, and quality information that they can trust. There is probably a threat from AI somewhere down the line in terms of other content, but I think what keeps bringing readers back to the Telegraph every year is that reputation. And I think people hopefully still appreciate that, and they don't want a robot telling them the stuff that inevitably the expert has a much better understanding of.
For sure. Maybe AI will improve out of kilter with how it looks at the moment, but I can spot an AI written article very easily just now, but it could be a threat for the future. Two other big challenges we've had since COVID. You already mentioned Brexit, and it feels like the ski industry has kind of seen off Brexit to a certain degree. I mean, we have seen prices rise and an impact on the market a bit, but the biggest existential threat on the horizon, or possibly even now, is the climate crisis. How do you see the climate crisis changing skiing down the track?
I think it's a topic that is only going to become more and more important for us to discuss. I think it's just going to change people's approach to destination, or what's important for them on a ski holiday. But in the same breath, I hope it actually allows people to see more from a ski holiday and not necessarily peg all their hopes on endless days back-to-back skiing and appreciating mountain resorts for more than just snow, and seeing them as the beautiful destinations they are and all the other activities that they offer. I think it will be interesting to see what the ski brochures, if we can use that word, what the programs that operators are offering in 5 years' time. Are all the same resorts still there? Do they all move a lot higher up in altitude? and what that means for price. I think in terms of price and experience on the slopes is where I'm seeing the biggest change, because people are wanting guaranteed snow. So they're all going higher to higher resorts. And inevitably, that's pushing prices up because demand in those particular areas is just outstripping supply in some respects. So I don't know the answer. I don't know what it's going to mean. I just know it's going to change things inevitably in the next few years. But some weeks I'd speak to some of the old school ski experts, ski writers, and they'd say to me, well, Lucy, 30 years ago, there was another challenge that the ski industry saw, and we got over it and we worked it through, and ski holidays are still here. I think the one thing we can always take from any challenge that the ski industry faces is that skiers will ski as long as they can, and we will keep skiing and we will find a way to keep skiing. Don't know where that will be or how it will look, but I think it's quite an exciting industry to work in the fact that the passion for ski holidays is probably unrivaled by any other holiday type.
Well, I would agree with you there. I think people will continue to go skiing, and it will be interesting to see what those effects will be. Very difficult to predict, but that trend towards altitude, when you see any survey, the Ski Club of Great Britain survey people on a regular basis, and always at the top of the list for the reason why they chose a particular destination, is the altitude and the reliability of the snow. And that probably will lead to a concentration of skiers in those higher resorts, whether that leads to an increase in costs or even a limit on the number of people who can actually ski on any particular day. Yeah. We'll find out in due course. But you're obviously very passionate about skiing. And I wondered if I could finish off. I mean, you've been lucky enough to go on many different trips all over the world. But I wondered if it's feasible from all of that, if you could pick out what your best ski trip that you've done so far has been.
So I knew you were going to ask me this question, and I should have prepared a thought and an answer for it, because it's such a hard one to answer. People ask me every year, oh, what's your favourite ski resort? And I can never give an answer, because for me, it's like wherever I am that time. I just, as long as I'm skiing and I'm in a mountain environment with great people, I'm having a great time. But if I was to think back on trips, and I've been really lucky with the opportunities this job has given me, I think the one in Chile last year that I came onto the podcast to talk about, in terms of an overall trip, and that bit of a pinch me, look where skiing has brought me, that would probably be my number one. It's closely followed maybe probably by Japan.
Two pretty good destinations. I mean, listen, if you'd like to hear about Lucy's trip to Chile, it kind of fits in with your previous comment as well, where you said that sometimes a trip is more than just a skiing. It's about all of those experiences that you can have in the mountains as well. And actually, that might be quite a good way to sum up, because, we started off talking about a trip to Nepal. There wasn't any skiing in it, but it's a love for the mountains everybody has. And I guess we all have perhaps a bit of luck in our career, but, you've been able to develop this career working in the ski industry and being a journalist, maybe not a magazine like Glamour magazine, but being able to write about something that you feel passionate about. So I think many of our listeners will really appreciate that, and also your advice on how you'd be able to develop a career in that area as well. So that's brilliant, Lucy. Thanks so much for your time. And I look forward to catching up with you at some point this winter and finding out about your next travels.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been really great to talk to you.
So that was really great to talk to Lucy, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation too. Now, I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'd like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Andre contacted us by email. He said, thanks for making another very enjoyable podcast. It really shines through that you enjoy skiing and nature. Well, Andre, I'm glad you spotted that, because I do. Now, listener, if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I see we haven't had a review on Apple Podcasts for a while. We've got a rating of 4.6, so chip in there if you'd like to. You can subscribe or follow us so you never miss an episode. And you can book your ski hire with InSport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST or take the link in the show notes. There are now 237 episodes of the Ski Podcast. 136 of those were listened to in the last week. There is so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories. You are bound to find something of interest to you. And don't forget as well that the equipment special episodes from this year have all been published on the Skipedia YouTube channel as well, if you prefer video with your audio. Now you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. I would like to thank Lucy for sharing her time with me for this episode. And fine listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you are right now. And until next time, goodbye.